Welcome to our discussion segment on Light and Darkness. I'm Joe Parker.
And I'm John Streeter.
Let's get started. Hey, John.
How's it going?
Good. Happy Friday night.
Same to you.
Yes. We're right where we want to be.
Yep, exactly. Definitely where we want to be on a Friday night.
Yeah. So
not with family, but with friends.
Yeah.
Sorry, Sarah.
Yeah. This was an interesting podcast
Good.
For a lot of reasons. One, I love the opening. I think it really told a story, and you painted a scene that we've talked about
Yep.
when we think about the fall of Rome. What inspired you to create this podcast in this way?
It was a desire to kind of dig into the Middle Ages, but also a recognition that, man, there's a lot in there. It's 1,000 years of history. There's tons to talk about. And to distill it down into 15 minutes is obviously impossible. So I wanted to find some major themes that transcended that whole period and then just kind of parachute into a certain moment or talk about a certain theme or person and to try and give audiences a quick snapshot of what the Middle Ages is like. Because we've done individual topics in seasons past and you're going to do one next week from the Middle Ages, but to give kind of the big picture first and then dive deeper into it, I thought this would be a good kind of tease to kind of set your episode up.
Nice. You talked in the podcast about why it's called the Dark Ages. But how did it get that bad? How did it, like, as we would perceive bad compared to Rome?
Sure.
And then, like, as it evolved into something more, like, why do you think society, I don't want to say de-evolved, or did it
de-evolve? It regressed, you might say.
Regressed,
yeah.
Yeah.
It really comes down to, I think, I don't want to simplify it too much, but one of the most important elements of the Dark Ages, and especially the early period, because now historians, if they use the term Dark Ages at all, they really refer to the early Middle Ages, so about 450 to about 800. And that was the moment where, until you see the rise of Charlemagne and the origins of the modern nation state, the world became very small. A person living in the Dark Ages in the early period is no longer part of this vast community of Rome. And what that means is they don't have the leisure time available to them to pursue their own interests, whether it's in art or music or something a little bit more directly useful to society as a blacksmith or a cooper or something like that. They're spending their time just trying to survive. Leisure time, going all the way back to the Greeks, was central to the good life and the ability to live in a community where one's needs were taken care of without you having to do everything, finding food, water, shelter, the necessities of life. That continues through Rome, becomes so integral to Roman society that you could go to a market to get the food you needed. You had aqueducts and plumbing systems that allowed you to have running water, in many cases, in your home in Rome. It wasn't everyone, but mainly the patricians and the wealthier plebeians. They had many of the modern conveniences that we have. That goes away in Rome, and so people no longer have the ability to pursue whatever interests they have. They're focused on survival. So the world goes from, I'm part of this massive, known world-spanning empire, to it's just my little town, or it's my small farming community. If they lived in cities, the cities were very, very small. Rome went from 1 million people down to about 50,000 in the span of 50 years. And when you have a community that's that small, even in a large urban area, you don't have the division of labor available to take care of everyone's needs. You have to focus on yourself. That was one of the key reasons behind the regression of society during the early Middle Ages. It's really a factor of time and leisure. I don't have the ability to pursue whatever interests I have and to make money off of it. I'm focusing on myself, my family, my local community, trying to keep us alive and trying to protect ourselves from these roving bands that existed. Feudalism helps to control that because we get the evolution of the warrior class, the knights who are going to fight.
Right.
But that doesn't come about until about 300 years into the Middle Ages. And so for that first 300 years, you literally, danger, as I said in the podcast, is just over the next hill or just on the other side of the next forest.
And did the evolution of the knight, was there a need that was seen to have that warrior class, or was it the noble class saying we need to control the serfs?
It was both. Well, okay. Oh, I'm sorry. It was not the nobles needing to control the serfs. It was the nobles needing to control all of these men who have the weapons and the training, and they're looking for a way to exercise those violent tendencies. They're soldiers. They don't know how to do anything else. Let's find a way to harness that, direct it towards a neighboring principality, and then as we get into the late Middle Ages, direct it towards people who disagree with us religiously and with the Crusades right. and things like that. So it was a combination of the two, as a recognition of we need a warrior class, and also we want to kind of harness the violence and keep it away from our own gates and our own communities.
What would you say the what percentage of Rome when it fell would be what we consider actually educated, meaning they could read. The reason why I'm asking is when we think about a republic, that concept was known. And if the people who were dispersed when Rome fell spread out, how did they take their education with them? And then, to your point, regress to a state where there was no government other than, you know,
just the local government.
Right.
Well, you have to distinguish in two ways. When we say that Rome fell, we mean the western half of the empire,
right,
because the east continues for another 1,000 years, continues a lot of the traditions of Rome, blending with Greece and some of the quote-unquote barbarian tribes of Central Asia and the Near East. So when we talk about Rome falling, it's the west. You also have to distinguish between regions. Italy escaped many of the hardships of the Dark Ages because while there was a great migration out of Italy and out of the major cities into the provinces, Italy is able to retain more people who were well-educated, who understood government. So a form of democracy and a form of the republic continues at a much smaller level in some of the major cities. But if you go out into Spain, into Gaul or modern-day France, into Germany and into Britain, there's almost no education. People don't have the time to learn how to read. They might know the very basics. You do have a lot of monks who are trying to preserve elements of classical learning and things like that, but it's really concentrated within monasteries. So those who were able to read were considered very, very valuable to society. We have to protect them within the walls of these very well-protected monasteries. So the bottom line is very few educated people lived out in the provinces where our farmer from the story at the beginning of the podcast, where he would have lived. He probably could read a few basic words, understand a few basic words in early French, but very little Latin. And if he was presented with a book, for example, if he was presented with St. Isidore's Etymologia, which is the first quote-unquote encyclopedia, he would be more likely to burn the book in order to keep his family warm than he would be to read it.
Was the regression of society one of the things that contributed to the lack of education?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so again, you don't have time to send your kids to a school if there even is a school. If there's someone in your town who can read and who can teach mathematics, science, history, language, your kids don't have time. They're busy helping you in the fields.
Right.
Helping take care of the home.
So the lack of education because of the lack of time meant that there was a void there. And so, in you're talking about the church at the time, there was this push to leverage that power.
Yes.
To say, this is what the book that you don't have time to learn how to read actually says.
Correct.
And
unfortunately,
that
leads to all kinds of corruption and things like that. Not every church leader, but a lot of them.
Right. Someone who didn't have time to do anything but survive, how far do you think they thought ahead in terms of planning their future? Was it specifically?
It was mostly day to day.
Okay.
I think. I don't know because very few records of peasant life have survived. But based on my assumption, studying the Middle Ages for a long period of time, I would imagine that it was very much day to day.
Okay. Because it seemed like the regression you talk about affected not just what were called the serfs at the time, but also the higher class. Because,
oh, yes.
Like when we think about a Caesar or somebody wealthy in Rome, if they looked upon somebody who was wealthy in the Dark Ages, be like, that's a squalor.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I mean, Julius Caesar, he learned to read at a very young age. But Charlemagne, he's too busy defending his kingdom, fighting all of his wars of evangelism. He doesn't have time to read until he's actually established his empire, become emperor of the Romans, and then he learns to read relatively late in life.
Okay.
So yes, you would, if you were to compare Julius Caesar or Augustus or even one of the later emperors like Diocletian to a lot of these medieval rulers, they would say, that's not wealth.
Okay.
You know, you're living in a castle in the middle of nowhere. What happened to the city that surrounds your palace or something like that? It's not there.
Hmm.
Aachen was a reasonably large city for having about 25,000 people. That was Charlemagne's capital, compared to Caesar Augustus, who lived in a city of 1 million people.
Hmm.
And he would just think, you run an empire of peasants. There's nothing glorious about it.
Hmm. Is it possible for society to regress like this again?
You would have to take away a lot of the technology that has made our lives so much different than anything even approaching what happened in the Middle Ages. But, I mean, play out whatever disaster scenario you want. Solar flare, EMP, Yellowstone caldera erupting or something like that. I think it's theoretically possible. I think that the material plenty, specifically here in the United States, would mitigate that to a degree. But it's important to note, especially for our international audience, that you know, the prosperity that we see here is not universal. There are people today who live in similar circumstances to those people who lived in the Dark Ages. It's a little less severe because they have the opportunity, if they can get to a big city, even in a very poor country, if you can get into a big city, there's a way to make money and a way to live the good life. But there is still plenty of suffering and privation like what we saw in the Dark Ages, even today in 2020.
Hmm.
Coronavirus, not even touching, you know, what's happened since then, since March, roughly 16 years ago, it feels like.
In thinking about medieval daily life, you touched on what it was like for a noble class to rule over serfs, how some of them were not all like bad. Some of them were good influencers. They were good leaders. Was there any check and balance on their power at all, other than from opposing factions? Like, if a serf was under someone who was what we would consider evil, would that serf have any recourse at all to get out from under that yoke?
They would have recourse to the church.
Okay.
If the local bishop or abbot or priest was not corrupt and in the pay of the corrupt ruler. There's edicts within canon law that dictate how you can treat your serfs. And as I talked about in the podcast, the rights that they have. So assuming that the local church official, because you can't just directly appeal to Rome, you can't send an email or a tweet or even a letter because there's no postal system. But assuming the local official is true to how he understands scripture and canon law and doctrine, they would be kind of the last recourse to deal with any kind of grievances or any kind of oppression or anything like that.
And if a knight in the service of the king or someone in that class assaulted somebody who is a serf, would that serf have any recourse against the knight?
First to the king or the prince, and if that doesn't work, then theoretically, again, presuming there's no corruption, to the local church official.
Okay. Would they be able to do anything to the knight? Like if a knight was assaulting someone in their family or hurting
are accounts of knights being punished, thinking especially once we get into the peace of God and the truce of God later on. We talked about that last season. All of you should go back and listen to our podcast on the Crusades. It was a really good one. We talked about those church edicts, which were designed specifically to limit the violence in the high and the late Middle Ages against the peasantry. Once we get that kind of control stemming from Rome and the popes wanting to make sure that, okay, if we're going to have, there's going to be violence, but we want it directed at other knights, whether it's tournaments or wars, not at the people who are doing the work, which after all, they gather the food that we need to survive.
And the belief was at the time, the knights are going to cause the violence anyway.
Correct. Okay. Correct. So there was increasing control and increasing regulation of that violence and increasing oversight of corrupt and evil knights and other warriors in various parts of Europe. Again, we're generalizing a lot because Europe is a huge continent, especially at this time where there's no transportation. So you have a huge variety of controls depending on where you are. But generally speaking, yes, there is a measure of restraint of the violence from the knights on the peasants, serfs and freeholders alike.
Is there a difference in between mainland Europe and what is now the UK in terms of the type of kingdoms that were present? Or were they the same kind?
Once, after the Norman invasion, and another podcast plug, Battle of Hastings, one of your best episodes.
Well, thank you.
Once the Norman invasion happens and we get the evolution of the common law, and where you don't just have church law and church canons, you also have the beginnings of civil law, England is going to develop very differently than France and Germany, kind of the other two major kingdoms in Northern Europe, and very, very differently from Spain and the Italian city-states. Partially because of the isolation and also the unique character of William the Conqueror and his successors going forward to King John that will culminate in Magna Carta and the beginnings of common law.
What was the rate, or was there a standard rate of what we would call turnover? So if you have a series of fiefdoms, if you have a group of them, what would their longevity be? Is there any data on how long a kingdom would last versus other ones? And does their lifespan vary over the 1,000 years?
Oh, yes, it varies greatly. There's not a standard that I know of, but you think specifically, I'll give you just to kind of compare. In the Frankish areas of Europe, the Kingdom of the Franks, which is, of course, where Charlemagne came from, by custom and later by law, a father had to divide his fief, whether it's a kingdom or a tiny principality, doesn't matter, among all of his sons. So you would have constant divisions going from, you know, one relatively large piece of property getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. It's one of the reasons why Germany failed to develop any kind of unified state until the 19th century. Whereas in England and also to the south in Spain, you have a very different system. In England, it's more about the shires and who controls the
shires.
Yes, that's what they're called, the shires. Right. Yep, the counties and the shires, led by a shire riff. That was the chief law enforcement officer. It's where we get the word sheriff from. In England, it was primogeniture, so the eldest son inherited everything. The younger children, the younger sons, would get money, but they would not be given, except in certain circumstances, they would not be given land. So the shires and the counties stay within a single family, so there's less division and thus less conflict within a family or something like that. And then, of course, in Spain, because of the Islamic invasion in around the 600s, I think, maybe 700s, with the introduction of Sharia, the Islamic civil law, that's going to upend the Vandal and the Gothic ideas of dividing stuff up among sons. So there's going to be more cohesion in Spain and in Britain than there is in Germany and Gaul, what is now France.
When we look at the art and music from this time period, obviously it's a long time period, but do you see a change in the type of art and music that was present or created at the beginning versus the end? And what is the prominent theme? Because when we went to the Louvre, the medieval art and sculptures definitely had a distinct difference between all other time periods. Mm-hmm. How would you classify that difference and how did it evolve?
So early in the Middle Ages, and you're talking about 1,000 years, in the early Middle Ages, after the downfall and during the regression, if there was art at all, very little of which has survived, it was almost entirely church-oriented. So it wasn't necessarily just depicting biblical imagery or biblical themes, but it was glorification of the church, of the papacy, and more than that, of Christ and the Virgin Mary and the saints. Once we get into the High Middle Ages, especially after the Carolingian Renaissance, art shifts towards depictions, yes, still of the church, but also the glorification of the state. So you get more mosaics and other art forms that deal with noble tournaments and noble life and the kind of the life at court. And in the late Middle Ages is when you start to see depictions of real life for the peasants and things like that. It kind of devolves down from each of the classes. You start with the clergy, then down to the nobility, and finally to the peasants in the early, the high, and the late Middle Ages.
So I know that you're not an art history expert.
True.
But I am curious, when we think about the Renaissance and the shift in the style, or styles.
Yes.
Would you say, based on what you've observed and read, that there's more light depictions and there's more of a secular look at things?
Oh, yes.
For
the entirety of the Middle Ages, it was idealism. It was, this is the ideal way to portray, whether you're talking about the church, the state, or the people. It's about idealism. It's not about depicting real life in any way. It's, this was what we would like it to be. Once we get to the Middle Ages, you think of the paintings that you see all throughout Italy. If you go to the Vatican or anywhere in Rome, it's still idealized, but there's more reality to it. And then once we get into kind of the Reformation and into the German Renaissance, it's really the Germans who start to say, no, we need to depict and chronicle what real life is like. I'm thinking of Albrecht Dürer. Some of his carvings, some of his work is just absolutely beautiful. You can look at a carving he did of Nuremberg, and I think it was in the mid-1500s, and he's on a hill, and he's overlooking the whole city, and you strip out the modern buildings and things like that. You can take, you know, an image, pull it up on your phone, and go to that same spot today, and it's almost exactly the same. That's partially a testament to the reconstruction efforts after World War II, trying to make Nuremberg look like it did before, but also to just his eye and his ability to capture real life in what he did. Now, you asked about not just art, but also music. It's very similar, except there's more of a church theme throughout the entire Middle Ages. What we know of early, high, and late Middle Ages music is mostly devoted to church themes. There's not a whole lot that has survived in terms of the glorification of the state or depictions of the commoners. It's really all praise of the Lord.
Okay.
And that continues into the Renaissance.
So we've talked about the progression of society, or sorry, the regression,
the regression
of society. What about warfare? So when we think about Rome had a pretty efficient way to conduct war, did that also regress? Was there...
Nope, that's the one area of real progress.
Gosh, isn't that amazing?
Oh yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Humanity is always looking for new and better ways to kill people and break things. When we get into Clovis's reforms of the military, and then Charlemagne, and then the developments once feudalism really gets going and knights spend their entire lives finding new and more efficient ways to fight. They develop whole arms industries. They're able to progress ultimately far faster even than Eastern societies. Western Europe, despite its cultural regression, is far more well-armed and far more able to project power. That's why we get the Crusades. The Eastern Empire is not able to hold out against the Islamic onslaught. But Western Europe, in that first crusade, it was incredibly one-sided. And even getting into the second and the third, if the two sides were roughly equal, the Europeans were going to win.
Huh. So we saw a regression in society, in government, in way of life, and a progression in warfare and combat, the ability to inflict harm. So that's not a great combination when we think about outcomes.
And in the general depravity of human beings, that's another bit of progress, I suppose. No, that's a regression as well, is the basic morality of human beings.
Because law was dependent on whatever fiefdom one found themselves under.
Yep.
Okay. You touched briefly in the podcast about Augustine's City of God. Can you give a brief overview of why he wrote that and what his central theme was in that book?
The theme was, don't panic. It was what John Paul II would say, be not afraid. It was a recognition of, yes, the world is changing, but what matters is not your citizenship in the earthly kingdom of Rome, but in the heavenly city of God. He was writing this between the sacking of Rome in 410 and the fall of Rome in the West in 476. During that period, millions of Roman Christians are turning away from the faith, turning back to the pagan gods of earlier centuries because they believed these guys are the true gods and they're angry that we've adopted this new religion, Christianity, and so they're punishing us. So they think if we go back to them, they will spare us. And Augustine is saying, no, that will condemn you to hell. What matters is that you remain a Christian and don't let the trials and the tribulations of this world distract you from the real purpose of your life, which is to serve God.
Yeah. I remember two specific parts of that book that it's a very long book, but it's outstanding. I love his arguments for basically saying, you know what, Rome wasn't that great. Here's why. But also there's a passage at the very beginning where he's talking about the motion of stirring a cesspool.
Yep.
And the motion.
Very graphic image.
Yeah. He was basically saying that the motion of stirring is the same, but the response is different.
Yes.
And throughout, he puts that at the beginning because he wants to say, this is what your response should be.
Yep.
The difference between a cesspool being stirred and a perfume pool being stirred, and that the fragrance that comes from both is distinctive, and one is right and one is wrong. And
it's a great metaphor.
Yeah, it really
great
is.
Image.
Yeah.
Oh man.
And that's one of the reasons why it stood out. And
we're talking about that in my world history class next week, and I'm going to bring that exact thing up and try and gross my students out right before lunch.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting thing to think on, even in our time.
Like,
what's our response to things?
Yep.
And it's an example to follow because when we look at
regardless of your religion, this is not
exactly. Yeah. And when we look at history, we gain context and perspective that things are challenging now for sure.
Yep.
But it's not the fall of Rome. I mean, it's not.
It could be worse.
The known world ending.
That comes in October, I think, is the free
we'll
month.
We'll edit that out.
Yeah.
In the podcast, you discussed Joan of Arc.
Yes.
And you gave a brief overview because to your point earlier, going through this time period,
and
a thousand years.
And she deserves her own episode and we'll get one at some point.
Absolutely.
Especially because there's more historical evidence that she exists than that you or I exist.
Really?
Oh yeah. She's the best documented, certainly the best documented person in medieval history because the English, believing in the common law and innocent until proven guilty, they wanted to document everything about her and prove that she was a witch. And so they sent people, investigators out all over northern France to document as much of her life as they could.
So that feeds into my question, well, why is she such a prominent figure in this time period?
Because of just the incredible nature of her story, that a peasant girl could present herself before the court at Chinon and be given an army. Basically, she's able to convince the Dauphin, the future Charles VII, I believe it was, to give her an army that she had been called by God to lead her people. He agrees to it. Most historians say, well, that was a reflection of his desperation, and it was. And then what she did with that army and how she's able to literally inspire the entire nation of France to rise against the English invaders, push them out, drive them off the continent of Europe, except for a tiny enclave around Calais, was pretty incredible for someone who was not of noble birth and who was not the right gender for a military leader.
So what was the catalyst for her to be able to convince the royalty to give her an army? I know that she would say was God, but right. I mean, like,
and,
what?
And it very well might have been.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. But
it part of it was the fact that she was able to, whether divinely or a good guess, or she had seen his photo, I almost said, or she had seen a portrait of him. When she arrived at court, there was a person on the throne, but it was not the heir. It was not the future King Charles. The Dauphin was in the crowd, and she's walking past, going towards the throne, and then she stops, turns, and says, "Your Majesty," or she recognizes him, pulls him literally out of the crowd. So that was part of their, like, whoa, there's something to this girl. Mm. That was the beginning. Then it was the passion of her words and of her spirit that convinced the prince to agree to what she was planning.
And she was a great strategist as well, right?
We don't know how much of the strategy was hers, or at least I should say, I don't know as much of the strategy. It was more her presence on the battlefield and her just absolute fearlessness in battle. She was fighting in the ranks with her soldiers.
Okay. How did news of her or people like her or events in general travel during this time?
It was mostly word of mouth. I mean, okay. There were no newspapers or anything like that. It was just word of mouth.
We talked about just now how she was perceived by the royal court. How was she perceived by France in general?
As a saint.
Okay.
Yes.
And though the English were trying to prove her to be a witch, did they actually believe she was? Or?
I don't know. Okay. That's a good question. I don't know.
Okay. So, very important question. Was King Arthur real?
What?
Or not?
Was King Arthur real?
Yeah. Are the stories in any way reflective of any time in history, or is it an ideal?
A lot of them are 19th century neoclassical and romantic inventions. It's probably an amalgamation of a number of leaders in Great Britain. There have been many people who have claimed to be King Arthur. If you go up to Scotland, in Edinburgh, there's a hill outside the town.
Right.
I'm sorry, right in the center of town, called Arthur's Seat, which is beautiful. If you ever, once COVID ends and you guys and everyone starts traveling again, if you go to Edinburgh, that's a beautiful hike.
Right.
Especially with, you know, a bottle of scotch in your backpack for consumption at the summit, it's beautiful. But as far as the historicity of a single man named Arthur who did all of those things, probably not.
Great job of dashing my childhood. I didn't think there was, but I was hoping you would say there was some validity.
That's my job. But, yeah, you know, another book recommendation. There's a series of books by Stephen Lawhead. The first one is called Taliesin. I don't remember the name of the actual cycle, but it's very, very good. You should all check that out. It's great. It's fiction, but it's really good. It ties Arthur into the legend of Atlantis, which is very good.
You had a section on medieval women, and in that you kind of gave an overview of what their life was like at the time. Yet in that same section, you talked about Joan of Arc and also
Eleanor of Aquitaine.
Right, yeah. So there's obviously a difference because of the classes, but was there ever an opportunity besides Joan of Arc to rise out of the peasantry into that nobler class and to serve in some way? Like, what was there any recourse for them during that time?
It was very rare. In certain parts of Europe, a noble could marry a peasant girl and could bring her into the noble class, but that was certainly frowned upon. It didn't happen very often. But I can't think of a specific example from the Middle Ages, but that's where we get the idea of morganatic marriages, where a king can marry, or a leader, a noble can marry someone who is a commoner, but their children don't inherit or anything like that.
Okay.
But it was certainly the exception rather than the rule.
So at the beginning of the podcast, you laid out a great story, the idea of somebody walking out of their hut after the fall of Rome and looking at a Roman aqueduct and seeing this monolith and being like, oh my goodness, this came from this amazing civilized society that I won't probably experience. Do we do that now? Do we look at specific time periods and we look at it and it's just like, oh my gosh, that had to be an amazing time?
Oh, okay. Absolutely.
How would you suggest to our audience that when we see something like that, we respond? Like, what are some suggestions you would have to somebody who would read about a specific time period or see something that looks pretty amazing?
Mm-hmm.
I know it's difficult right now, especially with all the technology we have and looking at our own achievements to say, well, you know, we're at the best possible place we could be in history. But people were able to do things. When you look at even the Roman Colosseum or the pyramids, that's amazing.
Oh, yeah.
It's absolutely amazing.
Aliens built that, Jack.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, it is amazing. You're right.
So that being said.
I just shut you down.
Yeah,
right there.
I was just like, I was not expecting you to bring up aliens. So like aliens aside.
Yes.
What are some suggestions you would give to our audience who would look at stuff like that and be like, oh my gosh, that's amazing?
Well, that's a good question. I would say, first off, read as much about the period as you can and don't necessarily focus on the great men and women of that period. For most of human history, records have been about the actions of the strong and the powerful. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with the great men theory of history. I tend to subscribe to it generally in that those men and women are the ones who shape our destinies. But you also need to look at what life was like on the ground. Don't just look at, for example, I think just back 2 centuries ago, I have members of my family who have commented, oh man, it wouldn't be so great to live in a much simpler time. You know, there's not technology, all this political strife, all this cultural change and things like that. I have students who say that kind of thing. And I think, okay, yes, that's absolutely true. And maybe it was a simpler time. But think about the health system. Think about just what things smelled like. Indianapolis, we're a relatively new city, but a century and a half ago, we had open sewers just flowing in the streets. Try to develop a well-balanced view of what things were like in the past at a time when you tend to idealize things. The best example of this that I can come up with here in the United States is the Revolution. People tend to idealize the Revolutionary period as a time when, you know, American men and women are standing up for our rights and our freedom, and we're saying, no, we're not going to take this anymore, and we break away from Great Britain, and it's a wonderful moment in our history, and if we were making a movie about it, the music would swell and be...
Everyone's singing at once.
Exactly. Yes, a lot of that is true, but that time period was one of the most violent periods in American history. Same thing with the Civil War. We think of, you know, we've talked about these two periods in an earlier episode this season, the blood and the gore and the violence and the death and the just general uncomfortableness.
That works, yeah.
We'll go with that. The lack of comfort in daily life. Yeah, it's great if you are one of the powerful, but odds are most people living now would be in roughly the same position as they are today in that time. And we live in a society where we have the sum of human knowledge at our fingertips. We can go down to the store and get anything that we need. We don't even have to go to the store. We pull up our, you know, our Amazon app and boom, it's there in 2 days. Thank you, Amazon Prime. You didn't have that in the past. We live in a great time in history. Yes, we have problems. Yes, this isn't perfect. Try not to idealize. Try to get a bigger picture of what life was like. And how do you do that? By reading, by listening to podcasts.
Apologies. By sharing great podcasts with your friends.
Exactly. By sharing wonderful podcasts made by hardworking historians here in Indianapolis.
On Friday nights.
On Friday nights. But no, get as big a picture. If history is something that interests you, of course, you have a daily routine and you've got other stuff going on, but find good books. We're talking this season a lot about books and other resources that are available to you that provide a balanced view of what life was like. Books like The Seven Ages of Paris, a great example of a history that doesn't just chronicle the great, but also the common. And that's really the best way to have a balanced view and an accurate view of any period in history. It's easier the closer you get to our own time where records are more accurate and you have less legend-making and myth-making going on. But whatever period you're at, grab as much history as you can.
Thank you for joining us in our discussion of Light and Darkness. I'm Joe Parker.
And I'm John Streeter.
Be sure to leave us a review wherever you listen to this podcast. It really does help. Thank you, and see you all next week.